Radio. This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to the Human Animal Connection Show, where we believe we can communicate with all animals. Join us as we explore the 33 principles and healing methods of the human-animal connection. As animal lovers, we know that you share our commitment to making the world a kinder place for all creatures. Together, let's embrace the transformative healing power of the human-animal connection.
Hi, welcome to the Human-Animal Connection. I'm your host, Michael Overly, and I'm with Jeannie Joseph. And today we're going to talk about the healing power of play. I think most humans need to learn this too, Jeannie.
Yeah, absolutely. This is as true for humans as it is for animals, because play is one of the things that restores our spirit, and it's a really healthy way to do it.
Yeah. Well, tell me more. So you say that play is an essential element of a balanced life. What do you mean by that?
Well, in our modern culture, we tend to overvalue work and productivity, which, of course, we need to pay our bills and all that. But what happens is that we undervalue play, most of us. I mean, some people are really good at playing, but for a lot of people, being an adult means that they're not playing as much. And it's a really important way to reset the whole brain, the nervous system, the spirit. It really gets us into that zone. And when we're in that zone, it could be anything. I mean, it's going to be different for everyone. For some people, it could be cooking dinner is their play, is their joy, is their fun time. The next person hates to cook dinner. So it's very unique. I mean, some people, you know, cleaning their motorcycle is going to be their Zen experience. So it's whatever gets you into that flow mode where you lose track of time and you feel connected to what you're doing. You know, either you love it or you feel so engrossed in it. That is play, and it's going to look different for everyone. And what we see in animals is that play is critical to their development, their social development, their physical development, their mental development. Deprived of play, they do not succeed as well later in life. And so play is not just something that's frivolous. Play is essential to any young being. But we also want to stress in the human-animal connection that play is important for humans.
It is. And I preach the same thing, and then I get busy and wrapped up in my own stuff and forget to play.
I know.
So isn't that funny?
I know. It's like we all, you know, this is a chronic condition. I mean, it's like if you talk to 10 people and ask them, you know, if they're getting enough play in their life, 10 are going to say no. I mean, it's part of our culture. So we have to constantly remind each other that this is good, and why we're resistant to good, I don't know. But, you know, play is a very good thing for the soul.
It is. It is. I used to have a favorite interview question when I was working corporate. Mm-hmm. And I would ask someone, it was always the last interview question was, what do you do for fun?
That's great. That's a great question.
Most people would think, what?
What?
Because they you know, they rehearsed and practiced.
Right, right.
And I mean, even in that moment, it's like, I don't know. What do I do for fun?
I know.
But isn't that funny?
It is. And Stuart Brown, who's MD, wrote a book on play. And his book influenced NASA JPL hiring practices. And this is one of the things that they looked at in addition to all their education and their resume and all the obvious left brain things. They would say to them as a child, what did you do for fun? And they found that the most creative people had very active play lives. And it doesn't mean necessarily that they had a ton of friends. It could be like they would build things in their backyard, whatever it was. But this was a very strong indicator that would tell them that this is an innovative and creative thinker. And that's what they were looking for in this particular position. They were looking for that. So that's a great that you did that in your interview process, because it really reminds us that as living beings, we need to play.
Yeah. And we need to continue that, right?
Right.
It's not,
yeah,
as you mentioned before, we get adulted and we forget to do these things.
Yeah. And that's why a lot of people having a dog in their life makes sure that they get some playtime in, you know, whether they're playing with a toy or a ball or whatever with that animal, or, you know, running around or whatever it is that they're doing, just taking a walk and smelling the roses, metaphorically speaking. The dogs can remind us of the power of play by seeing how much they play. It's why we love to watch kittens and puppies, you know, because all this play is just like you can't be unhappy and watch kittens or puppies play.
Right.
You know, they're just so full of what's this? What's that? What can I do over this? How can I make this happen? You know, and that's a wonderful quality for our nervous system. It's part of our well-being is to exercise this portion of our nervous system just as it's important to exercise the work and the productivity parts of ourselves. We need that too. But play helps us be more productive. And a lot of the more modern companies like Google and stuff will have, you know, play areas in the office that people can just go play for a few minutes or whatever, you know. So that's a great new development, thanks to the science of play. Because there was a time that play was just considered frivolous. It was just something kids did. And now we're really understanding how significant it is in a person's balance, the balance of life.
So there's a movie called My Octopus Teacher.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you something.
Yeah.
So we focus on the dogs mostly in this program, but what about an octopus? Can an octopus flirt with
yes.
a human?
Yes, they can. Well, that's a wonderful documentary. I hope everyone has had a chance to see My Octopus Teacher. And it really helps you expand. You know, we had thought of octopuses as being very, I think that's the correct, octopuses. I think that's correct. I think I read that. Octopuses, we think of them as kind of solitary, but they are capable of all kinds of play. And one story was with Cy Montgomery, who's written the book The Soul of an Octopus, which is a wonderful book. And she describes a situation for visiting an octopus in an aquarium. And it's very difficult to keep octopuses in captivity because they're so playful. They will figure out locks. They will figure out how to, you know, they don't have bones in their body, so they can shrink themselves through the size of a quarter, a hole the size of a quarter. It's very, very difficult to keep them in captivity. But anyway, she was visiting this one octopus at an aquarium, and, you know, this octopus knew I forget what you call them, the people that work there, you know, the handlers. And they were engaging with this one octopus, and there was a bucket of fish at the bottom of the feet of Cy Montgomery, the woman who was doing this interview about the octopus. And this octopus used a couple of their arms to just like suck on her, you know, like just kind of crawl up, you know, very gently, very sweetly, kind of caress her arm with these tentacles, and completely engrossed her and the other person that she was with. And they did not notice. They thought this octopus was just being friendly. She stole the bucket of fish right literally by their feet. You know, they were so engrossed in this experience. So this octopus had the strategy, you know, could think about, okay, let me seduce them. Let me flirt with them. They're not going to notice that I'm going to steal the whole, they didn't notice until like the bucket was empty. That was on the last fish, you know? So it's really fun to see them strategize like that and to enjoy. I had a friend who was a dolphin trainer in Hawaii. And he told me this one story about they had to do these like really, I would say, boring academic tasks of move the red ball to the blue net, move the green ball to the orange, you know, just little stupid things that they had to do that these dolphins knew exactly what the cues were. They knew how to do it. They were doing them. And they just had to go through these repetitive drills for this particular study that they were doing. And it was, of course, you know, kind of boring for the dolphins. And so one day they all went on strike. And this was always videotaped, you know, all these learning sessions. And no matter what they did, the dolphins wouldn't do it or would get it wrong, even though they knew it. And they were sort of frustrated and they turned away. And then when they looked back at the camera, they saw that when their backs were turned, they did all the commands perfectly, but never when they were watching. You know, and I think that they would just sort of swim listlessly, like, yeah. But, you know, they would set up these games with the trainers, and they were often ahead of the trainers with these antics.
So how did you discover the importance of play?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I was play deprived myself. I was, you know, a single child of a single parent, and I didn't have a lot of play myself. So I think I put myself in the very play deprived category. You know, my mother was working and then she was in the theater. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of like childlike play for me in my life. And so of course I was drawn to improv comedy because it was so playful for my own personal therapy. And at the time I was working with soldiers with PTSD, and I would literally go to an improv class on a Monday and teach it in class on a Wednesday. You know, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew it was good. And after time, I developed a system called ACT Resilient, which uses laughter and improv comedy, expressive arts. And it was so powerful to see what it could do for soldiers with PTSD. You know, sometimes nothing else was working for them, but this, just because it was play, it didn't feel like therapy to them. And it just allowed them to, I say, unstick the brain, you know, because a traumatized brain can get stuck in the fight, flight, or freeze. And what the play does is it loosens the stuckness, so that, because you're making new choices and new behaviors and moving your body in different ways. And that helps loosen the grip of the trauma response. So I was just in awe of how effective this was. We were getting over 80% reduction in symptoms of PTSD. And kind of threatened some people who were more traditional, but it was very, very effective. And then towards the end of the program, or about 2 years into the program, actually, I brought in some therapy dogs, and I saw what they could do in minutes to just get people into their play energy and to just be right here, right now, in the moment, engaged. And I thought, this is amazing. So that's kind of how my progression with play worked, you know, from being kind of play deprived myself to being really a champion of play. And then to recognize that the animals can really show us just more than any book could ever do, you know, how to play, how to just be here. Because how can you not smile when you're watching your dog play, you know, just throwing that ball and having a good time or whatever it is that you're doing. And not all dogs like to chase balls. Some people are disappointed that their dog doesn't like to do that. Like Sophia, I could throw a ball and she just look at me like, why'd you do that? You know, you know, no interest in that. But yeah.
Well, it's fun because Indigo is often smarter than I am. And Fetch turns into, I'm going to grab the ball, but you have to chase me to get it. So we've kind of left that, because that's kind of a thing for her. Uh-huh. And that makes her really happy. And I'm like, I could really care less if she doesn't fetch the ball.
Right.
But it's fun, right?
Right.
So I act all, chase her around the yard, and she's having a great time. Right.
Yeah. Well, chase is a really fun game for animals. You know, little kids like it. They kind of grow out of it. But chase is very primal for animals. So a fun chase game, not a threatening chase game, not a game where they feel threatened, but a fun chase. You'll see them in the play groups. The dogs will do lots of chase activities. And in a healthy group of dogs, one dog, you know, dog A will chase B, and then turn around and they'll reverse the roles of who's the chase and who's the chasee. And that's a very balanced situation. If you see a dog that only chases or only gets chased, that's a dog that maybe has some, you know, insecurity or maybe some dominance issues. But in healthy dogs, play and chase are huge. It's just a very fun thing, more fun than get the ball, bring it back, which is the human version. They're much more interested some dogs are natural fetchers, but a lot of dogs are much more going to enjoy a game of chase. Mm-hmm. And if you know Coco the gorilla, do you know Coco was mm-hmm. taught sign language? Yeah. So she used to love it when people would chase her, you know, just a little, you know, back and forth in the yard, just.
Mm-hmm. And tickle. She loved to tickle.
Love to tickle, you know, and that's another thing that's really fun is now that we have more sophisticated audio recording equipment and can hear sounds that the humans can't hear, we've now discovered that many species laugh. In fact, most of the species we've studied do laugh, so that horses, rats, dogs, there's even chimpanzees. They've discovered that dogs actually have a laugh, and it's almost inaudible to the human ear. It's not really loud, but dogs can hear it. And when you play that in the shelter, sounds of dogs laughing, it calms them right down.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really great. And Jacques Panksepp, I hope I said his name right, he did some studies and he discovered that rats, when they were tickled, they would emit a sound that we can't hear, but the computer could hear, and the other rats could hear and recognize it as laughter. But what was really interesting is that the designated tickler, the moment that person walked into the room, they started to laugh in anticipation of being tickled.
No.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
We think we're so smart. Oh my gosh. So smart. Seriously. Yeah.
Seriously. And that's what that study about rats has really made me think a lot about anticipation as being a really healthy tool in working with trauma. So you've heard me talk on other shows. In fact, we'll talk about it in the next show on focus about how that can help the positive anticipation of expecting something good, a treat that you know is going to come, but come slowly, that they can watch and get ready. That is so good for their brain. It's the antidote to the fear stuck response. The stuck, frozen in fear response is curiosity, pleasurable curiosity. So play helps with trauma, helps unstick the brain, and anticipation as one aspect. When we think about, oh, we're going to go do this fun thing, we feel happy already, right? If it's fun, we're happy.
That's amazing.
before we started.
Dana does that with me when she says, do you want to, she asks me, do you want a cookie?
Yeah, exactly.
And I get excited. I'm like, yes, I get a cookie.
Yeah, I want a cookie.
I haven't even seen it yet.
Exactly. You haven't tasted it. You know, I mean, you have it from memory, but the fact is the experience of anticipation, she's smart, you know, because she's got you right in the state of, I mean, who's going to, you know, she could say, you know, anything after that, give me $1 million. Okay. You gave me a cookie. Okay. You know, I mean, because in that state of anticipation, it's just feeling really, really cooperative and really curious and really peaceful and content. It's not a low level of energy. It's a higher energy, anticipation. It wakes up the nervous system. So it's a good thing. You know, anticipation and play are two really good tools for relieving stress and for healing trauma.
It's so simple, right?
Yeah.
It's so simple.
It's so simple. And it's, you know, and it's unique for everyone, you know, because one person's play is going to be going for a run. Someone else is going to, you know, work on their motorcycle. Someone else is going to bake a cake. Someone else is going to read a book. I do jigsaw puzzles. You know, it's very calming to me. It's a silly activity in a way, but it's very tactile and it uses your sense of color. It brings a lot of the brain things together. I think jigsaw puzzles are really underrated as a healing tool. I mean, they're sort of like made fun of, but you know, they're really powerful for meditative Zen states. And play and Zen, what they have in common is that you're in the zone. You are feeling connected to the experience. Most of the time we're doing things, we're multitasking. We're doing the dishes, but we're thinking about who we need to call later, or we're on the phone and we're thinking about what we need to do to get, need the dishes. We often have split focus. And what play does is unifies the brain. All of our cylinders are firing in one direction. All of our horses are going in one way. And that is a healing experience. When we're split and multitasking and, you know, in a meeting that we don't want to be in or whatever it is, that is creates a stressful state for the body.
Love it. Amazing, amazing, amazing. Hey, let's take a quick break and we'll come right back.
Hey, friends. If you like what you're hearing and want to learn more, check out Dr. Joseph's book, The Human-Animal Connection, Deepening Relationships with Animals and Ourselves. Or visit the website, thehumananimalconnection.org, to book an online consultation. Thank you for loving animals. Now back to the show.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
All right, welcome back to Human-Animal Connection. Oh my God, we've been talking about play and octopuses, the importance of play. I wanted to ask you, what is the purpose of play?
So for young beings, it's developmental. You know, they're learning how to use their bodies. They're learning how to coordinate. They're using how to work their mind, their vision, their sight, their sense of space, all of the senses coming together. If it involves contact, they're getting the touch stimulation from the other puppies or kittens or the little monkeys or whatever it is. So there's so much that's happening developmentally. So that's in the early stage of life. They're also learning behaviors, like the lion cubs are learning all those little chase games that they're playing with each other. They're learning the skills that they're going to need later in life to be able to be a predator. So it's social learning, it's cognitive learning, it's well-being. So those are all the elements in a young life, but the new science says that that continues. There's no reason to stop that. It's just that in the early life, it's like critical for development. In later life, it's critical for sustainment. So what do they say? People with Alzheimer's and dementia play some games, do some puzzles, do this, do that, you know, listen to music, dance, do all these things. So any amount of play is restorative for the brain, including people who are experiencing senior decline.
But it's interesting. I was talking to a neighbor this morning. Excuse me. I was walking Indigo, and she had the opportunity to meet my neighbor's dog a little closer, not just from the fence. And his dog, Sweet Pea, it's a giant Anatolian Shepherd. Uh-huh. He's just a baby, but he's big. Uh-huh. Yeah. He was fine, but in, you know, Indigo, first time meeting. And again, we were coming at each other. Ooh. So, and he was kind of curious. I said, well, I don't think she learned how to dog very well. Like, she didn't get that socialization. She was pulled from mama early, thrown in a backyard.
Yep.
And she didn't learn how to dog, right? So I was thinking of that when you're talking about the lions playing, they're learning how to lion.
Exactly.
And when humans are playing, they're learning how to human.
Very nice.
Right? Yeah. So we all need that.
We all need that. Yeah. Yeah. And when puppies, if they've been taken away from their puppyhood and their mother too soon, they don't learn proper bite inhibition, because that's one of the things that puppies learn in play, is they're nipping each other. And another puppy will go, ah, if it's too hard. And they go, oh, okay, that was too hard. And they learn that. It's the only way to learn it, really. And if they didn't get it as puppies, it's a lot more challenging to get it later. And that's where we see some of these issues of bite issues. I'm going to be working with a client whose dog has been biting her, and because she was given some very bad advice by a trainer, which she followed, and it really broke the bond. So yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see if we can reverse that. Looking forward to working with her.
You can.
Yeah, hope so.
Wow. Awesome.
Otherwise this dog's going to lose its home, you know, because it's been several bites.
So what about shelter dogs? Mm-hmm. Right? Because you know, we know about we try and go to play dates with our dogs sometimes, or maybe the dog park, which obviously isn't appropriate for everyone. And I think people need to understand that that's not a place to train your dog. But shelter dogs need to play, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Just on dog parks. Some dogs do great in dog parks, and some dogs, that's their worst nightmare. So every dog is unique, but if you have a dog that loves it and is safe and behaves well, that's a great thing. But if you don't, don't think that every dog is going to love a dog park or be safe in a dog park, not only in terms of other aggression. If a dog is too vulnerable, taking them to a dog park, they can become victimized very easily by other dogs, because that's a predatory thing to sense the weakness and to rule it out. So you don't want to take a vulnerable dog, a sick dog, a shy dog to a situation where they could increase their level of fear by being at the mercy of other dogs. So that's about dog parks. But about shelter dogs, there's an organization called Dogs Playing for Life, and they are a wonderful organization, and they have really innovated the notion of play being as essential as any other need in a shelter environment. So of course they need food, water, shelter, medical attention, but next after contact they need play. And one of the things that they do is look at the different ways in which dogs play. So they will make their distinctions between dogs that are gentle and dainty. They're kind of like the wallflower at a party. You know, they're very, you know, they don't necessarily want to be rough and tumble. And there are other dogs that want to do rough and tumble that looks like wrestling. You know, they look, they're like rah, 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 on two legs, and they're, you know, making a lot of noise, and they love it, you know. So for dogs who have that play style, that's really good for them. And just 20 minutes in a play yard, in a balanced play yard, meaning that that humans are making sure that dogs are separated by style and that they're watching out. 20 minutes of play is equal to a 3-hour walk in terms of stimulation for the dog. But it's more than just the physical stimulation. It's the mental, emotional, and social stimulation that animals need. And so the one thing that, if I could wave my wand, my magical genie wand, to change all of shelter systems, would be that they all have play groups led by people who are trained to lead them. And at the shelter that I work at, PAC, Pima Animal Care center, they have play groups every day, and they can get sometimes 200 dogs out a day. And that's more than any walker could ever do, you know. I mean, they get walked also, but these play groups are just phenomenal to watch the dogs learn social skills, because the dogs will teach each other. They will show each other what appropriate play is, and they will signal and say, nope, that's not okay. And if that dog doesn't know how to read that, that's not okay signal and back off, there's going to be a situation. So there are situations where the humans have to intervene, but mostly the dogs work it out. Mostly, not always, but mostly the dogs will learn from each other, unless you have a dog that's very imbalanced and who's not learning and paying attention. But it's wild to watch how fast the dogs know. I was one day observing a training with the dogs playing for life at the shelter, and we were watching an interview, and they were going to bring in this dog that couldn't be walked by anyone. Only one person who worked at the shelter could walk this dog. So that means it got walked very little, because no volunteer could walk him. He really aggressive, bite history, the whole thing. So he never got out, you know, and Dogs Playing for Life folks said, well, let's put a muzzle on him and let's put him into the playgroup, right? And so they have this thing which is called a catch pen, where the dogs can meet each other with a barrier between them before they go into the play yard, which is just brilliant. And what was interesting, you know, the dogs will look at the incoming dog, they'll come and greet the incoming dog, they'll make a determination, this is a dog's okay, boom, everything's fine. In seconds, they have decided this dog's okay to let into the yard. Then there are other dogs that provoke a completely different response. And this one dog that was the issue dog, none of the dogs knew this dog because the dog wasn't out ever, but they brought into the catch pen, and all the other dogs, what we call helper dogs, went to like the corners of the yard, laying like the Sphinx, just watching the front gate. So they were neutral. They were saying, okay, we're calm, but they were on guard. They were watching. And all of them did it simultaneously the minute this dog came. So they could sense the energy, this unbalanced energy of this incoming dog, and vice versa. They can sense the energy of, okay, this is going to be fine. And we can see watching it, the wonderful people leading these play groups, they can tell in an instant that the dogs say, yeah, this dog's in, or we're not comfortable with this dog. And just watching the dogs, it's so much faster than our human responses, because our human responses, we'd be like, okay, this dog just did this and this and this and this and therefore that, and it takes, you know, several minutes. With the dogs, it's seconds that they have made a determination who's okay. And then they bring the dog in with the muzzle, and, you know, he was, you know, carrying on and making a lot of noise, but eventually the other dogs decided, oh, that's just noise, it's nothing. And they could tell by the other dogs that the muzzled dog was understanding to be calmer. Things completely shifted. 5 minutes later, the muzzle came off and they all played. So play groups are an extraordinary way to really evaluate a dog. And one of the problems in shelters is that, especially like the one that I volunteer, big municipal shelter, 75 to 100 dogs a day coming in. Okay, 75 to 100 dogs coming in. So it's very fast evaluation. You know, this is a friendly dog, not friendly dog, this, whatever, very fast. In a situation where the dog is at its most extreme stress, they don't know where they are, they don't know why they're there, they don't know when they can leave, they don't know anyone. So they're being evaluated under a high stress situation, which is a terrible way to evaluate the dog. And the dog may be showing signs of growling or whatever, just all kinds of discomfort. But in the play group, you really get to see who they are. And you see that they're really good with all dogs, or they're what we call dog selective, meaning they like certain dogs but not other dogs. So playgroup is a phenomenal way to get a more accurate evaluation, which helps in all the notes that go into the adoption. And then potential adopters can say, oh yeah, this dog gets along with everyone, or this dog only likes littler dogs, or whatever it is. That'll be in the notes. So that's my wish, that all shelters would have a playgroup like that.
Wouldn't that be something?
It really would. It really would.
So how do we help them understand this? And then obviously for shelters, it's typically a matter of resources to, right, as to what they can put their money towards.
Right. So yeah, so we totally understand that shelters are totally strapped for resources. But as we educate the public, and the public comes to say, hey, this needs to be, just like we need to have good food, water, medical attention, walking in a shelter, we also need playgroups. And over time, you know, it used to be in the beginning, when Best Friends started the no-kill movement in shelters by 2025, people said, that'll never happen, there's not enough homes, and, you know, whatever. And it has really taken off. You know, it's not completely, the world is not no kill, but many shelters now no kill, moving towards no kill, or at least valuing moving towards it. So it's the same thing with the play groups. If we can educate people how important this is, A, you know, first taking care of your own dogs, the dogs that share your life, but also helping shelters to understand that this is a priority.
Right. Awesome. Yay.
Yay.
I love that. I think I'm going to go play.
Yeah, I think we'll go play now. Yeah, and our next episode, we're going to be talking about the power of focus, so I hope that you'll join us for that.
Oh, yes. Yes, I will focus on that.
All right. See you next time.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Aloha. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Human-Animal Connection Show. Please visit our website, thehumananimalconnection.org. There you can sign up for our free email newsletter, book a consultation, or check out our blogs and resources. Our best-selling book, The Human-Animal Connection, is available on Amazon. And your donation of any amount keeps our nonprofit organization providing life-changing services. You can reach Michael Overly, author of Let Your Dog Lead, Musings on How to Create an Exceptional Life, on his website at dogsandmen.com or email michael@dogsandmen.com.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.